Welcome back to another installment of It's About Time, DC Sports Podcast. I am Nate. I will be running solo tonight. Josh could not make it for today's episode, but we wanted to make sure we got one out early in the week. So, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Before we get started, I will remind everybody that we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com. That is the DMVSportsNetwork.com. They are a great up-and-coming DC Sports website. They cover all things DC Sports. They have a little bit of a national twist. They handle MMA, tennis, anything you can really think of. They've got a debate podcast coming out, kind of in the kind of ilk of what's that show, Stephen A. Smith and Skip Bayless were on, that kind of stuff. They've got great stuff going on. Check them out, dmvsportsnetwork.com. You can also check them out on Twitter, at DMV _SN. They're doing great stuff. We're happy to be affiliated with them. They also release a podcast today. You can follow us on Twitter. It's About Time DC1. That's ITS About Time DC1. So be sure to give us a follow. Let us know what you think of the show. Give us some ideas. If you have some questions or anything that you want to talk about, we are always happy to hear from our listeners. So welcome. Just got a few topics today. It's going to be more of a national scope today. Not a lot happened locally. You had Sunday, the big football day, AFC, NFC championship games, and they were anything but boring. And a lot of things we're going to be talking about over the next couple of weeks, especially heading into the Super Bowl. So we're going to talk about that first, and then the Baseball Hall of Fame. The class of 2019 was announced today. You've got four members that were voted in by the, the press. So we'll talk about that. I've got a couple questions about two people who didn't get in, whether they belong in or not. And then the final two topics will be more localized. Dan Snyder meddling again in the coaching staff of the Washington Redskins. He apparently, according to Jason LaConfora, tried to personally go out and replace the defensive coordinator without the help or, consent or input of his head coach. And it sounds like we might be back to the old Dan Snyder ways, the Vinny Serrato days, where he thinks he needs to be more involved so that the team is more successful. So that should be a lot of fun to watch, if anything. I mean, it's not going to be fun on the field, but off the field. They were certainly fun from March until September in those days. I guess we'll probably see a little bit more of that moving forward. And then finally, the baseball's hot stove has been anything but hot. It's more of a frozen stove. Less and less teams are competing. Still have two of the probably most talented free agents to ever hit free agency at 25, 26 years old, still sitting out there. No real offers being made to them, at least offers that they would accept. So I'll dig into that a little bit. I just find that fascinating. Unlike Josh, I am shocked that Bryce Harper has not. I thought there would be a team, like the Texas Rangers did with A-Rod, a team that was just going to come out and blow his socks off because of what he could mean to your ticket sales, what he could mean to your fan base. I'm surprised that that hasn't happened. I'm actually at this point right now, I think that there is more of a chance than ever that he returns to the Nationals. I don't think he returns on a deal that he finds to be completely favorable. I think he's going to have to make serious concessions. But if there is a team that he and Scott Boras can go to and negotiate a face-saving deal for him, but also a deal that is team-friendly, it would be the Nationals. And the Nationals would be silly not to listen. So I do think that it's possible that he returns to the Washington Nationals. But anyway, let's start with football. Championship Sunday was this past Sunday. The day started with the NFC Championship game, the Saints and the Rams. By the way, both games, both football games did go into overtime. The Saints and the Rams went into overtime. The Rams ended up winning on a 57-yard field goal by Greg Zuerlein. I mean, let's just start off right out of the gate. Greg Zuerlein, ice water in his veins. The guy to hit two huge field goals about 20, 25 minutes apart from one another. A 48-yarder with 15 seconds left. Essentially, he misses, the Rams season's over. He nails it from 48 yards. And then a 57-yarder in overtime to win it and send his team to the Super Bowl. Both kicks were no doubters. Greg Zuerlein, ice in his veins. But my first take is a bit of a... It's hard to say this. To me, the Rams are illegitimate NFC champions. Now look, did they do a lot of good things? Yes, they did. Especially after the non-call, the non-pass interference call, they did a lot of good things. They marched down the field with about a minute and a half left, got into field goal range, and then forced the turnover on Drew Brees in overtime and kick a 57-yarder to win the game. But let's be honest. Drew Brees throws the pass out into the flat with, what, a minute and 50 seconds left, somewhere in that neighborhood, and the receiver gets absolutely mauled. And there's no pass interference call. If the pass interference call happens, the pass was intended for Tommy Lee Lewis. There's a minute 49 left at the 13-yard line of the Rams. If the pass interference gets called, the Saints take three knees, kick a field goal, and the game's over. That's it. Game's over. It would have been a 30-ish yard field goal, basically an extra point. The game's over. So the Saints had the game taken away from them. Now let's not forget that in the early part of the game, the Saints twice were on back-to-back drives to start the game, were in the red zone and got conservative with their play calling. For some reason, Sean Payton decided that he wanted to put Taysom Hill in a couple of times, and they ended up kicking two field goals, so they scored 6 points instead of potentially 10 or 14. That also had a huge impact on the game. Sean Payton did not have his best day, but to me, I think the Rams are illegitimate NFC champions, and if they win the Super Bowl, to me, they're the most illegitimate Super Bowl winner in history. I think that there's a huge asterisk because it was such a blatant pass interference. It was such a blatant non-call. It was obvious. It was one of those that it wasn't a judgment call. He got to the receiver two steps early and annihilated him. He even said after the game that that was his plan, was just to take him out because he was wide open and he would have walked in for a touchdown. Guy made broke on the ball, made a great play. Nickell Roby Coleman was his name. Made a great play, broke on the ball, saved a touchdown, but at the same time, I mean, if he turns around, instead of leveling the receiver, if Roby Coleman turns around, he intercepts it and might have a pick six and they win the game. But instead, he annihilates the receiver, gets lucky. So basically, him making a stupid play saves the game for the Rams. To me, and it's not sour grapes. I'm not a Rams fan. I'm not a Saints fan. It hurt me. You think about a football team, they played 18 games this year, the Saints, played their guts out. To have their season taken away from them like that, that's something I don't think you ever get over. If you're Sean Payton, if you're Drew Brees, how many more bites at this are you going to get if you're Drew Brees? This might have been his last great chance to play in and to potentially win another Super Bowl. And it was taken away from him. It bothers me. It bothers me. It left a bad taste in my mouth. And as a lifelong NFL fan, it was a bad look for the NFL. And I'll say this. The NFL's lucky that this was their early game. Had this been their late game, this would have been a much, much bigger story. They were fortunate because the game after that, where the New England Patriots faced the Kansas City Chiefs, that game also went in overtime. That game saved the day for the NFL. Now, that game did not go cleanly either. I mean, there were bad officiating calls. There were points on the field where there were dead time because the referees were trying to figure stuff out. It was a long game, 3.5 hours. It did go into overtime. Patriots did win 37-31. What I'll say is the Mahomes-Brady matchup, it lived up to the hype. It really did. I mean, both quarterbacks had pretty good days. Brady did have two picks, but he was 30 of 46 for 348 yards. Should have had a third pick. That's the back-breaking play of the game. If you're the Kansas City Chiefs, you have a game-winning interception, and it's negated because one of your defensive linemen is lined up in the neutral zone. That's a backbreaker. Unbelievable. Pat Mahomes, 16 of 31, 295 yards and three touchdowns. Their numbers look good. I mean, Mahomes had 117 rating. Brady only a 77.1. But the big thing for me was that the fourth quarter especially, we went into the fourth quarter, and it was 17-7. What was that, 24 points. So overtime in the fourth quarter combined, there were, 38 points in the fourth quarter and then 6 points in overtime. 44 points in the fourth quarter and then one drive in overtime. That's remarkable. It was a heavyweight fight in the fourth quarter. I mean, both quarterbacks slugging, going back and forth. It was an amazing game to watch, and I can't wait to watch Pat Mahomes in the future. The guy has got it. He did not shy away. I mean, he started out slow. I think that the Pats were putting pressure on him. They were making him think quickly, and I think that it took him a while to get his heart rate down, and it took him a while to get comfortable in the game. But once he did, man, I'll tell you, he really looked good. Kansas City is going to be a force to be reckoned with for a while. They're a good football team, and that was a great football game. The Pats, they had a perfect game plan. I mean, they kept Kansas City's defense on the field. They were 13 of 19 on third down, including three huge third down conversions in the overtime drive that ended up with a touchdown. But the Pats held the ball for 43 minutes and 59 seconds to Kansas City only holding it for 20 minutes and 53 seconds. There was no chance that Kansas City's defense was stopping the Patriots in overtime. They were gassed. By that point, Brady was just in a rhythm. There was no chance. Great football game. I will say this, and this is a bit sour grapes because I went to school in Boston. I have a lot of friends that are Patriots fans. I am just sick of watching Brady do this year in and year out, march down the field in the highest pressure situations, throwing dime after dime after dime and bailing his team out. He did get lucky because there would have been a game-ending interception in the fourth quarter that was negated by the lining up in the neutral zone penalty. But, man, he's the greatest of all time. Is there any other way to put it? He's the greatest quarterback in the history of football. There's no other way to put it. 13 AFC Championship appearances. I mean, the guy, he's special. There's something special about him. There's nothing that you can say in a negative way about him. He's amazing. But I will say he did throw an interception at Kansas City's 34-yard line. It hit off of Gronkowski's hands. Ward intercepted it for Kansas City, but it was negated because of the lining up in the neutral zone. So, Super Bowl, Pats, Rams in 2 weeks. I'm looking forward to the game. You've got the young offensive mind, the most popular coach right now in football in Sean McVay. Stings a little bit if you're a Redskin fan because he was here. And everybody knew how special he was when he was here. And right now I don't think there's a Redskin fan that wouldn't trade Jay Gruden for Sean McVay. I mean, that's just a stupid question. But, and then you've got the greatest coach of all time, Bill Belichick, Tom Brady. It's going to be a good game. If I had to lean one way or the other right now, I mean, how can you not lean Patriots? With their experience, they seem to have hit their stride at the right time. Brady looks like Brady, and he's got Gronk. I mean, don't sell the Rams' defense short. The Rams, on paper, have a very good defense. I like Wade Phillips as defensive coordinator. But my feeling has always been if you give Bill Belichick 2 weeks to plan for somebody, I think that he'll find a way to slow down the Rams' offense. And to be completely honest, I haven't been that impressed with the Rams' offense. I mean, they only put up 26 points against the Saints. And also, if you're going to take a quarterback, Jared Goff or Tom Brady, give me Tom Brady every day of the week, twice on Sunday. I think it'll be an okay game. I think the Patriots probably win it pretty easily, which is kind of nauseating. I don't want to see them win another Super Bowl, but that's probably what's going to transpire. Common themes from the weekend in the NFL. The first one, and I'm on this bandwagon, the officiating was garbage for the most part. It really was. I don't understand on the muffed punt by Julian Edelman how they overturn it. I don't think he touched the ball. I think it should have been Pat's ball. But you can't, the ruling on the field, if it's not conclusive, then the ruling on the field stands. It was not conclusive. It just wasn't. There's no way to prove one way or the other whether he touched it or not. I don't know how you do that. You had the phantom roughing the passer penalty on Tom Brady, where they said they hit him in the head. That kept their, you know, that really gave them momentum in a drive in the fourth quarter. When he didn't hit him in the head, he hit him in the shoulder pad. And, of course, the big non-call in the Saints-Rams game. Officiating, it's been a question mark all year, and these are supposed to be two of the best crews in the NFL. It was not a banner day for the officials, and it will continue to be a black eye on the NFL. I don't know how you fix it. These guys are moving so fast, and there's a lot for these officials to know, but it just was not a good day for the officials. Second, kind of overarching theme is that the overtime rules suck. And that's speaking really to the Patriots-Chiefs game, that Mahomes never got to touch the ball in the second half, or I'm sorry, in overtime. I kind of agree with that, but if you look at the Rams-Saints game, the Saints won the toss, and they didn't win the game. I think it's reasonable to say if your defense can't stop the other offense from scoring a touchdown, then your offense doesn't deserve to touch the ball. I think it's reasonable to say that. I think to say we're going to go to a college-style overtime where you just start with the ball at a certain yard line. Had they done that, in my opinion, no matter where they start on the field, had they done that in the Pats-Chiefs game, it just would have been a shootout. Because neither defense, in my opinion, was stopping the offense. Both offenses were humming at that point. You might have had a quadruple, quintuple overtime to decide that. You don't want that in the NFL. I mean, to me, I watch a college football overtime, in my opinion, that's not football. To give them the ball at the 25-yard line, it's not football. It takes out special teams for the most part. Football to me is, line up and you got to stop them. And Kansas City could not stop the Patriots. Patriots marched down the field 75 yards, scored a touchdown. Patriots deserve all the credit. Is it a shame that Pat Mahomes didn't get to touch the ball in overtime? Absolutely. I would have loved to see it. I wanted the Chiefs to win. But I don't know how you make the overtime rules. Maybe in the playoffs, maybe just specifically in the playoffs, you get rid of, you say both teams touch the ball once, and then it's, sudden death. So you say, if the Pats scored a touchdown, Chiefs get it, they have to score a touchdown, obviously, and then it's sudden death. But then if you go to that, both teams score a touchdown, you're in the same situation. You're going to have people that are going to gripe and go, well, Mahomes only got to touch the ball once, Brady got to touch the ball twice. At some point, your defense has to make a stop. It just has to. And I don't know where you draw the line. I think you can attempt to even it out by saying that both teams at least have to touch the ball once. But I've never been a big fan of the college rules. I mean, I think they're better than sudden death or no overtime at all. Like the sudden death where you just kick off and whoever scores first wins. I think that's better than that. But I think what the NFL has right now is the best version of overtime, especially in the playoffs. And I'm sure they'll get looked at, but I don't think there'll be any changes. And then the one big conspiracy theory that came out, a lot of people talking about how the NFL is rigged. And I got to tell you, man, it's just that is a bunch of nonsense. Absolute nonsense that the NFL is rigged. The NFL would have been happy with any of these four teams making the Super Bowl. First, you have the New England Patriots. They have been the gold standard for two decades. Greatest coach of all time, greatest quarterback of all time. NFL would happily have them in another Super Bowl. Kansas City Chiefs, you have the likely MVP in the AFC in Pat Mahomes, who is also the most electrifying young player in football. You have the best offense in football in Kansas City Chiefs. And you have the story of Andy Reid is one of the best coaches of the last two decades, has never won a Super Bowl. They would have been very happy to. And Kansas City is one of those marquee franchises. They're one of the old school franchises, had not been to the Super Bowl in, what, 40-some odd years since Super Bowl IV. The NFL would have been happy to have them in the Super Bowl. Then you go to the Rams and Saints. Drew Brees? Who wouldn't want to see a Drew Brees, Tom Brady Super Bowl? It just doesn't make sense. You'd love to see that. And then the Rams, I mean, yes, L.A. was a big project for the NFL. They wanted to put a team in L.A. The fact that 2 years, or what is it, 2 or 3 years after they put a team in L.A., that team's in the Super Bowl, I mean, that's a big win for the NFL. Don't get me wrong. But the idea that the non-PI call, was because the NFL wanted the Rams in the Super Bowl, that's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. I'm sorry. The NFL is too big of a business to potentially destroy itself by becoming illegitimate. It just is. It's too big. It's not like boxing. Boxing, a lot of people know that boxing, there's a little bit of gamesmanship that goes on with the judging, and it's not boxing. The NFL is not boxing. The NFL is a $10 billion a year industry. I can't see that. It's just not. I think that it's just sour grapes. It is, you know, the Saints today, there's a lawyer filing a lawsuit on behalf of season ticket holders with the NFL. I mean, that's a joke. They're talking about a class action lawsuit of all the gamblers that had money on the Saints. That's a joke. It's just people that are bitter. People that had rooting interests, whether that because they were rooting for the Saints or because they lost money. Move on, people. All right, the NFL's not rigged. And it was a good weekend for the NFL. Could have been a great weekend if it wasn't for the non-call PI, but the Chiefs and Pats really did save the day. All right, let's move on to the Baseball Hall of Fame. Pretty big class this year. I mean, the classes in recent memory, I mean, I think they had 1 year where nobody got inducted. The Baseball Hall of Fame is clearly, or not clearly, but in my opinion, is the toughest Hall of Fame to get into. But this year, we've got four new names that were voted on there. You've also have Lee Smith and Harold Baines, who were were put in by the Veterans Committee. But you have four players that were voted in. You have Edgar Martinez finally getting in. He's been a controversial figure over the last several years because he was primarily a DH. You have Mike Mussina getting in. Also, finally, I mean, the guy, sabermetrics really helped him. I mean, he had 270 career wins. But he was one of the best pitchers of his era, and he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. The late Roy Halladay, getting in a year after, I believe it was a year after he passed away, was probably the best pitcher of the early to mid-2000s. I mean, you got Pedro in there as well. So I should say mid to late 2000s. Roy Halladay definitely deserved to get in. And then the first ever unanimous decision. Every single voter voted for him. The first time it's ever happened. Mariano Rivera going in, the great Yankee, greatest closer of all time, et cetera, known for his cutter. Good for Mo, man. I think that's fantastic that he was the first unanimous Hall of Famer in history. I am surprised, and I was surprised and shocked, I should say, that at least in recent memory that Griffey wasn't a unanimous Hall of Famer. But Mo deserves it, man. Great player. I mean, I've never been a Yankee fan, but he... You got to tip your cap. I mean, regular season, postseason, the guy deserved to get in. You look at some notable numbers. Obviously, Mo got 100% of the vote. Three players that did not get in. Curt Schilling had 60.9% of the vote. For those of you that don't know, you need 75% of the vote or more to get in. So Curt Schilling was about 14% under. Roger Clemens, 59.5%, and then Barry Bonds at 59.1%. Bonds and Clemens did not see much movement in their in the number of votes that they got. Schilling did see a pretty big uptick. The feeling is that Schilling will get in next year. It's also possible another player who saw a very big spike was Larry Walker. It's possible that he will get in as well next year. Two players I really wanted to touch on, and they're both controversial for totally different reasons. And I'm going to start with Barry Bonds. And the question is, does Barry Bonds belong in the Hall of Fame? And most, not most, there's a good portion of people. Clearly, there are 41% of baseball writers that say he doesn't, mainly because of, well, it's 100% because of his steroid use. I don't agree with that. Barry Bonds is a Hall of Famer. No question in my mind, he's a Hall of Famer. Let's look at just overall numbers right now. Obviously, he is the all-time home run champ, but he's also fourth all-time in WAR. The three names at 162.8 wins above replacement. The three names above him, number one all-time, Babe Ruth. Number two, Cy Young. And number three, Walter Johnson. The name directly behind me, behind him, excuse me, not me, behind him is Willie Mays. Barry Bonds is a Hall of Famer. And here's why I say he's a Hall of Famer, and you can discount, get rid of the steroid argument. I know you can't, listen, Barry Bonds is synonymous with steroids. He did, unfortunately, he became, because of how fantastic he was in the early 2000s, he became the, I guess, epitome. He just became the picture of steroids. But let's look at his numbers in what I would deem to be his pre-steroid era. 2000s when his numbers really kind of took off. If you look at it in the year 2000, he hit, if you want to just look at power numbers, he had 49 home runs. His previous high was 46, but that was in 93, so 7 years earlier. And then obviously, or not obviously, but in 2001, the year after he had 49 home runs, he hit 73. So that was the big spike, because prior to that, 1999, he had 34 home runs. But he did hit 34 home runs in 102 games. He was a little banged up that year. So I'm going to look at the numbers pre-2000, basically his age 21 through his age 34 season. During those years, he averaged almost 32 home runs a season, 93 RBIs. He had 445 career home runs by the time he was 34 years old. He had a 287 batting average, a 407 on-base percentage, and he was a 968 OPS guy. He was a Hall of Famer at age 34 in 1999. He could have retired with 445 home runs, a career 968 OPS, on-base percentage over 400. He would have been a Hall of Famer. At that point, he had, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 gold gloves. At that point, he had 460 stolen bases. Guy was a Hall of Famer. So Hall of Famer pre-2000, pre-steroid use. Barry Bonds is a Hall of Famer. I don't think there's any argument there. In my opinion, Barry Bonds is a Hall of Famer. He's one of the greatest hitters of all time. And you add to it, in my opinion, you add to it the people that he was playing against, the majority of them were also on performance-enhancing drugs. He was playing against competition that was juicing as well. Not all of them, but by most estimates, it was 60-70% of Major League Baseball had some form of performance-enhancing drugs during that time. He's one of the 5-10 greatest players of all time. In my opinion, he belongs in the Hall of Fame. He will eventually get there. His personality and the fact that he's the face of steroids has certainly kept him out. No player accused of steroid use has made it into the Hall of Fame thus far. He will be the first, and he will eventually get in. Eventually, there's just going to be... You're either going to have a black hole in that era, or you've got to let him in. He's not Rafael Palmeiro. Okay? He's not Sammy Sosa. He's not even Mark McGwire. he is clearly better than all of them. And also, he was a five-tool player. He was an MVP in 1991. And again, 8 gold gloves prior to the year 2000. Hall of Famer. 445 home runs before his age 35 season. He's a Hall of Famer. So my second question, Curt Schilling. Now look, I don't like Curt Schilling as a person. I loved watching him pitch when I was in Boston. Great pitcher to watch. But I didn't like him as a I don't like him as a person now. I think that he's a vile human being. I just don't like him. He doesn't jive with me. But if I'm just looking at him and trying to be objective, first thing that pops out is that he pitched 20 seasons and he averaged 30 starts a season. That's pretty impressive. He's very, very durable. With the exception of 2005, where he only started 11 games, he's very, very durable. And he had a 364. Let me make sure I have that right. Yeah, 346, excuse me, career ERA. He was almost 80 career WAR. Mike Mussina, who just got in, was 92 career WAR. But the thing for me, like, look, Schilling never won a Cy Young. The highest he finished was second. He finished second 3 times, 2001, 2002, and then 2004. He was a 3-time World Series champ. He won in 01 with Arizona and then twice with Boston in 04 and 07. He was an All-Star 6 times. 4 times he finished in the top 15 in MVP voting in 20 seasons. Based on that alone, he's a borderline Hall of Famer. 216 wins. I don't like to look at wins. I think wins nowadays, people know it, you can't put wins on a pitcher. You can't take wins away from a pitcher. But his WHIP was pretty good for his career. What really separates him to me, and this is why I'm going to say, even though I don't like him as a human being, he belongs in the Hall of Fame. He was a phenomenal, phenomenal playoff pitcher. He started 19 games. It was 11-2 in those games. Had a 2.23 ERA. He had 120 strikeouts in those 19 games. He elevated his game. When he got to the playoffs. And he was instrumental in the 3 World Series championships. A lot of people, it's hard to forget 2004, the bloody sock game against the Yankees, all that stuff. He's a Hall of Famer. He's a Hall of Famer when you put together the whole package. And I think he gets in next year. I think he deserves to get in. He was one of the best pitchers, and to last 20 seasons, 3 World Series, he belongs in the Hall of Fame. All right, let's move on. Before we do that, first of all, I'm going to take a sip of water. I'm going to remind everybody we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com. That's DMVSportsNetwork.com, an up-and-coming DC sports website. They have a bunch of great podcasts. Give them a follow. Give them a listen. They're doing great stuff. We're happy to be affiliated with them. They've got great written content, great audio content, and they continue to improve their website, add talent. They're going to be somebody to watch. And follow them on Twitter at DMV_SN. Be sure to follow us on Twitter as well. It's About Time DC1. That's ITS About Time DC1. Give us a follow. Let us know what you think. 2 more topics. These are more local. These are the DC sports topics. Again, not much to talk about this week. I mean, we could talk a little bit Wizards. We could talk about how the Caps continue to be in a bit of a slide. But I want to talk about Dan Snyder. According to Jason LaConfora, Daniel Snyder aggressively pursued both Todd Bowles and Greg Williams. This was per the report from Jason LaConfora. While this is about Todd Bowles. While the sides did not enter into negotiations, sources said. Snyder was leading this push, not head coach Jay Gruden. And the owner made it clear he would compensate Bowles as well as any coordinator in the NFL and was also willing to alter his personnel structure within football operations if Bowles was interested. I'm going to repeat that. Was also willing to alter his personnel structure within football operations if Bowles was interested. As one source with knowledge of the situation put it, Dan put the full court press on Bowles. He didn't want to let him leave. He wanted to know what conditions it would take to get him to stay. If Todd Bowles had said, "I'll only do it if I'm the head coach," I think Dan would have gone for it. This is the old fly him in on Redskins 1, lock the door behind him at Redskins Park, and you don't let him leave until you've got a contract. They did that with Josh Norman most recently, but they did it with Albert Haynesworth. They've done it with umpteen number of free agents. This is, if you're a Redskin fan, this has got to worry you, because Dan Snyder has stayed out of the news for the most part in the Bruce Allen era. Since the firing of Vinny Serrato, Dan Snyder has pretty much stayed out of the news with, unless there's, like, when he was buddy-buddy with RG3, that made news. But beyond that, Dan Snyder, at least outwardly, it did not appear that he was making personnel decisions. It did not appear that he was making coaching decisions, like when he brought in Sherman Lewis, the bingo caller, to undermine Jim Zorn. It appeared that he had at least learned from that, but apparently not. Apparently he thinks that the remedy to the Redskins, doldrums, is him re-entering himself into the fray and going after coaches. Now, this bothers me for two reasons. One, Jay Gruden wasn't part of the process. Jay is the head coach. He's the boss on the field, and he wasn't part of the process. The other thing that bothers me, if you're a Redskin fan and you want to see the Redskins succeed, is that neither one of these people fell for Snyder's push or wooing. And we talked a little bit about this last week, about how free agents and coaches might start avoiding the Redskins because of just the toxic atmosphere in Ashburn, and how Washington is really, it's a laughingstock in the NFL. And why would anybody, any coach, come here? And I've said on previous podcasts that the only reason I wanted Jay Gruden to continue as coach, but the only reason he's still coach is because they legitimately didn't think that they could get somebody else. And the reason why they went after these two people but didn't fire Greg Minuski was because if they fired Minuski and couldn't get these two, then they don't have a defensive coordinator. It's a clown show over there. Dan Snyder, obviously, I mean, I don't think anybody thought he had learned from previous mistakes, but he has clearly not learned from previous mistakes. And this is a sign that things are going to get much worse. It started with the Bruce Allen is, of course he's staying, and not only is he staying, we're expanding his portfolio. To this, it's only going to get worse. I'm starting to really believe, I don't know. It's quite possible Jay Gruden is not the coach at the start of the season, that Dan might go in another direction even this late in the offseason. But if Jay is the coach for game one, I'd be shocked if he's the coach for game 16. I don't think he makes it through the season. And it'll probably be a mercy firing for him, because I'm sure he's probably pretty close to wanting to get out. I mean, he's a great offensive mind. He could latch on somewhere as an offensive coordinator. I also think that it's quite possible he'll get another shot as a head coach. I think he's done an admirable job here, especially it's very difficult circumstances working for Washington. It's going to get a lot worse, guys. It really is. If Dan Snyder is going to be more hands-on, and he's got his number one sidekick in Bruce Allen, his yes man, who's going to keep Dan in that Ashburn bubble, telling him he's doing everything he needs to do, we might be entering the darkest days of the Redskins franchise since Snyder has bought them. I think that we might be entering into them, especially, I don't know if any of you saw it, the picture of Alex Smith at the, you know, he visited the Wizards locker room yesterday and then watched the game. The brace on his leg, not a chance, in my opinion, based on the way he was getting around and the bracelets on his leg. There's not a chance he plays this year. So you're looking at Colt McCoy, Josh Johnson, maybe a rookie quarterback. It's going to be, we're entering dark days. We're entering very dark days. And Dan Snyder is going to make them even darker, and there's no end in sight. I'm sorry to say it. But that really bothered me, that story, because I thought that he had at least learned from that, and obviously he had not. Final story I wanted to talk about, or the final topic I wanted to talk about, was baseball's hot stove. Obviously, the two top big free agents are still out there, Bryce Harper, Manny Machado. It appears, really, that Machado has maybe two suitors, real suitors, the White Sox and the Phillies, and that Harper maybe only the Phillies, which is amazing. Neither player has gotten or has been made an offer that they feel comfortable with. They both wanted 10 plus years with opt outs, $30+ million a year. Doesn't look like they're going to come anywhere close to that. Nick Markakis, who was an all-star this year, or last year, I should say, in 2018 for the Braves, he signed today, re-signed with the Braves, got $4 million this year. He was an all-star last year, got $4 million this year, got a one-year deal, $6 million option in 2020 with a $2 million buyout. That's just a sign of the times, man. If you're over a certain age, most front offices won't touch you, or if they do, they're going to give you a 1 or 2 year deal. I mean, look at Daniel Murphy. He's been one of the best hitters in baseball for 3+ years. I mean, yeah, he was banged up last year, but you have to expect that he'll have a bounce back year this year. He gets 2 years, $24 million with the Rockies. You look at Brian Dozier. You know, the power was there last year with the Dodgers and the Twins. Batting average is way down, had a down year, but he's only a year removed from 30+ home runs. He gets a one-year, $9 million deal from the Nats with no options, no second-year options, nothing. You got a lot of free. I mean, Craig Kimbrell's still out there. Dallas Keuchel's still out there. It's disheartening. And I know that, I'm on the side of the players. I'm on the side of the players because the owners are making money hand over fist. And I'm not one of those people that's like, players are finally getting a take. No, I don't think that at all. I think the players baseball is more profitable than it's ever been. The players deserve to make more money. They just do. And it's a combination of things that's causing this issue. The first thing is you do have a larger group of teams than Major League Baseball should be comfortable with that are just outright tanking. They're not going to be competitive. They don't want to spend money. They're going to hoard their money. They're going to play a lot of young guys, and they're basically tanking. They're following the Houston Astros blueprint or what the Nationals either inadvertently or on purpose did in the 08, 09, 07, 08, 09, losing 9,500+ games a year to land Harper and Strasburg. Or what the Astros did to land a couple back-to-back number one picks or however many. The Astros drafted really well, and they won a World Series, and now they're going to be a perennial contender for the next several years. Teams are trying to mirror that. So you have a lot of teams that are tanking, especially in the American League. A lot of teams in the American League are tanking. More teams, I think, are tanking than are being competitive. So that's less people spending money. And the other thing, too, is that these new people working in the front offices, they're all about analytics. They're all about it's all data-driven. And they look at a Bryce Harper, $30+ million a year, and they say, well, we can get his output from somebody else that's going to be 50% or 60% less than he is. I mean, they look at Bryce Harper and his mirror right now, production-wise, is Chris Davis in Oakland. Josh has said that over and over again. Davis has actually hit for more home runs than Bryce has. Bryce does have the MVP season in 2015, but that's 3 years ago. I'm genuinely shocked. I thought that these two guys, they would be different because of their age. I was wrong. Both of these guys are going to have to take deals that nobody thought that they would take at the beginning of the offseason. But I think it's a bad look for Major League Baseball. And I think we are headed towards when the next CBA comes up for negotiations. I believe we are headed for a work stoppage. I think that the players are going to have to strike to get down the service time from 7 years for a rookie to four. I think you have to, so that you have more players hitting free agency in the middle or at the beginning of their prime, 24, 25, 26 years old. It's the only way that they are going to make the money that they deserve. Don't get me wrong, in your sixth, seventh year of arbitration, like Anthony Rendon, who's one of the, in my opinion, one of the top, he's certainly one of the top third basemen in baseball. He's making $18.8 million this year in his final year of arbitration. Bryce made like 20-some million last year, his final year of arbitration. The really good players, they make their money. It's the mid-tier guys that, you know, they're just not getting paid. And they deserve to get paid. Major League Baseball is making a ton of money. They deserve to get paid. And one final stat I saw about the Nationals, it made me very happy. And it made me glad to be a Nationals fan. Is that they showed a statistic of percentage of revenue spent on payroll. And the Nationals were number one. More than 65% of their revenue every year is spent on payroll. More than any other team in Major League Baseball. They're not the highest spending team. I mean, they're one of the highest, but they're not the highest spending team. That's the Red Sox. But the Red Sox make so much more money than the Nationals do. So do the Yankees, so do the Dodgers, because their TV contracts are so lucrative. The Cubs as well. Their TV contracts are so lucrative. But the Nationals remain competitive because they stay out and they go and they spend money. The Nationals have been more aggressive in free agency this year than just about any other team, if not every other team. Sean Doolittle went on Twitter, I believe it was last week, was talking about how bad this is for the players, but said, he's like, I can confidently say my team goes out and improves itself, spends the money. Chris Bryant came out and during Cubs Fan Fest last weekend and said how discouraged he was that guys like Machado and Harper, two of the best players in baseball, were not being highly pursued by multiple teams. Evan Longoria went on, I think it was Instagram, and talked about how discouraging it is and how it should scare players. And in my opinion, we're heading to a work stoppage because of it. I mean, that's a few years down the road. Owners are going to have to recognize this. I don't know if they will. I don't know if they're going to be super greedy. I don't know how it's going to work. But owners are going to have to recognize this because players, Major League Baseball, it sounds like an obvious statement, but Major League Baseball is nothing without its players. And yeah, I hate to see players get treated this way. I'm not one of those people that's like, screw them, they make enough money as it is. No, man, listen, you work your whole life. You give 7 years to a team, because that's what's mandated by the collective bargaining agreement. And then you hit free agency and you have a chance to cash in on all your hard work. And it just dries up and nobody's interested. And then the only thing you can get is maybe a 1 or 2 year deal. You know, if you're one of those mid-tier players, it's a joke. And for a guy like Max Scherzer, who's, in my opinion, the best pitcher in baseball, to not hit free agency until he's 31, to where he's really, most people would think that's probably middle of your prime. He should have hit it at the beginning of his prime. He could have made a lot more money. Bryce and Manny are lucky. They both debuted at 19, so they were able to hit free agency a lot sooner. Another player that's going to be lucky like that is Juan Soto, although I'd really like to see the Nats in a couple years try to extend Soto if he continues to play as well as he did. It's going to be an interesting, on the business side of baseball, it's going to be interesting to see what happens moving forward. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, we are 20 days away from the Nationals pitchers and catchers reporting. Now, the Nats team is done. They're loaded. They're ready to go. I mean, aside from, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I do believe now, and I still don't think the Nats are the favorite, but I do believe now more than I've believed all offseason that there's a decent chance that Bryce Harper does end up back with the Nationals, because this is the team that if they had to go to a team and go, let's work something out that's face-saving for us, it looks good on paper, but really it's beneficial to both of us. You know, it's backloaded, there's deferred money, all that stuff that would benefit the Nationals now. The only team he's going to go to is the Nats. He's not going to give that to the Phillies because he doesn't know the Phillies. Why would he do that? He's not going to give that to the White Sox, who aren't even a contender. The Phillies aren't a contender right now. They would be if they added, you know, their dream, I think, was to add Harper, Keuchel, and Kimbrel, or at least that's what was being reported. Who knows how much of that is accurate. But yeah, the next 3 weeks are going to be amazing. I think Bryce and Manny both signed before pitchers and catchers report, but you never know. I mean, if these guys are adamant, and if they're going to take a stand, and it's going to take a player taking a stand and going, no, I know what I'm worth, because Major League Baseball does not want a Bryce Harper or a Manny Machado missing a season because they couldn't agree to a contract. And I think it would be smart for Bryce to accept a one-year deal and reset his market because he's so young and he's coming off of a year that, well, yeah, he hit 30-plus homers, had 100 RBI, but he only hit 248, and his defense was terrible. Come back one season, make $25, $30 million in 1 year, blow the doors off, have another MVP-caliber season, then you really increase your value if you believe in yourself. But Manny's not going to do that. Manny has no reason to do that. And Major League Baseball doesn't want Manny or Bryce to sit out a season because they're going to go, we're going to wait until we get offer work. They don't want Bryce and Manny pulling a Le'Veon Bell. So will this reach a breaking point? Will a team come in and offer them the right amount of money? It's going to be interesting over the next few weeks. We're going to keep talking about it, obviously, because Bryce is a Nat, at least until he signs somewhere else. And it's one of the most intriguing off-seasons in baseball in recent memory because of the two people at the top. And then you still have a very good starting pitcher in Dallas Keuchel, former Cy Young winner, and one of the best closers in baseball in Craig Kimbrel. Yeah, I look forward to seeing what's going to happen in the next few weeks in baseball. I think the Nats team's pretty much set, aside from maybe some minor league deals with some major league camp invites. But we'll see what happens. That's all I've got. I thank you guys for joining me. Reminder, we are affiliated with DMVSportsNetwork.com. That is DMVSportsNetwork.com. Great up-and-coming DC sports website. Everything you want to know about DC sports, you can get it there. They also have great podcasts that they are a part of. We're happy to be affiliated with them, happy to be one of the podcasts that they blast out. So please follow them on Twitter at DMV_SN. Follow us on Twitter. It's About Time, DC1. That is ITS. About Time, DC1. Tell us what you think of the podcast. Subscribe to us on all podcast platforms. Rate us wherever you think you can rate us. Let us know what you're thinking. If you have any questions that you want answered, anything you want us to discuss, shoot us a direct message on Twitter. We're happy to hear from you guys. Would love to hear what you're thinking. Anyway, hope everybody has a great week. We will be back next Monday, and we will talk to you guys soon.